This is the second lecture then on multiculturalism in the United Kingdom. And last week I went through the first few of these slides and spoke about a few symbols of multiculturalism, and then about immigration over the last 150 years and the changes which had been brought in, and the most recent change being the opening up to some new countries from the European Union the possibility to come and live in the United Kingdom. And here you had the number of Polish-born people in employment in the UK from 2003 till 2010. So you can see it levels out around 2008. I think that after 2012, I think it went down a little bit, but not so much. Although this is a rather specific demographic, in that quite a lot of these people are young adults who are hoping to go back to Poland, and maybe they will, because that's becoming easier. Of course, immigrants have always dreamed of going home, but normally do not go home because it's more complicated to go home. My ancestors were Irish. And they came to England thinking, oh, we'll go back to Ireland one day, but maybe we will, but I'm still waiting. Yeah, it can be very difficult to go home again. Okay, so that was that side of it, and I want now to go through a brief history of the three main waves of immigration in Britain, and then in the last section I will go on to the question of key dates in racism, in the history of racism and anti-racism in Britain, because I think I explained last week that I consider the history of racism to be depressing, whereas the history of racism and anti-racism is a little bit less depressing. Okay, so there you have them. First of all, the big wave of Irish immigration after 1840, in particular with the big famine in the 1850s, the late 1850s, the potato famine. At this time, a large section of the Irish population lived only on potatoes and milk. You can live on potatoes and milk for a remarkably long time. Potatoes are very good nourishment. And then there was a disease in the potatoes, and a quarter of the population died. Another quarter left the country. It was the founding myth of Irish identity. Remember, I'm using the word myth in the technical sense. It doesn't mean it's not true. It means it's become more important than what really happened. And even today, you can easily find Irish people who are very angry at the English because food was exported from Ireland to England during the famine. And people are still angry about it today. That's something you can't miss. Please do. Okay. You can put your desk there if you like and just plug it in. Yeah. Okay. The second big wave of immigration, Jewish immigration, in three different waves. First of all, a 17th century Jewish immigration, much smaller, of course, and people didn't move as much in the 17th century. Secondly, a wave of 1880 to 1910. 30 years, which I will be speaking a little about, which is a time when it was very dangerous to be Jewish in Poland, in Russia, and London was one of the places you could go to, because of course if you need to become a refugee, it's better to go to a big town. There's more jobs, there's also people you know probably. And finally, of course, 31 to 46, with the terrible tragedies of European anti-Semitism. The third big group is what we call West Indian immigration. The West Indies has remained as the British English name for the Caribbean. Les Antilles, the West Indies, les Indes de l'Ouest. Parce qu'ils pensaient que c'était l'Inde, mais ce n'était pas l'Inde. Je vous informe, comme ça vous êtes au courant. The West Indies, people coming over there from 1948 to 62, mostly. So participating in the reconstruction of England after the war. England after the war was in a terrible state, like Normandy as well. Well, not as bad as Normandy, but a quarter of the buildings in London were damaged by bombing. That's nothing compared with Caen, which just disappeared, but you know, we thought it was a lot. There was a need for a lot of workers, and a whole number of West Indian came over at that point. In the same period, but lasting a little bit longer, then Southeast Asia, not in India, but India, in fact, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, a big wave of immigration there. These places, the West Indies and Southeast Asia, there is today almost no new immigration. It's very difficult if you're Indian, if you're an Indian today and you want to come and live in Britain, it's very difficult. If you don't already have your parents there or something. And finally, the one I spoke about a moment ago, East European immigration. Now, it has to be said that there has always been a lot of immigration from Canada, Australia and America, but because of the way politics works and because of the way racism works, very often when in British political life people talk about immigration, they're not talking about Canada, Australia, New Zealand of the United States, they're talking about non-white immigration. So let me move on to three little histories, probably about 10 or 15 minutes on each group. So first of all, a very short history of Jewish immigration. There are a certain number of books written about this. I saw a book recently about the Jewish youth clubs. 100 years ago, the youth clubs were very important for every religion, and the Jewish youth clubs were a feature of London life. So today in Britain, you have, I think it's the second biggest Jewish community in Europe after France. France is the biggest Jewish community in Europe. And the second one is in Britain. And of course, like in all countries, there are many Jews who are not really religious. But the religious organizations are these. The biggest one, the United Synagogue. And then which is the more orthodox, perhaps more traditionalist. And then the other three, which are Reform Judaism, Liberal Judaism, and the Masorti synagogues. The Masorti synagogues is the most avant-garde, if you like. For example, if you are a woman, you can be a rabbi in the Masorti synagogues. And today, I think there are a few women rabbis in Reform Judaism, whereas in the United Synagogue, you're not going to be a woman rabbi, just to give you use that that sort of question as a symbolic point. So there you have the groups of the religious organizations in Britain today. And they have a certain amount of importance on the public stage. So there, for example, you have an example of the JC, not Jesus Christ, but the Jewish Chronicle. This has been published in London continuously since the 1840s. So you can see it's a long presence for a newspaper. Very few newspapers can think of that. And there you can see an example. This is one of last year's papers, and you see that the big news, our star generation, GCSE students excel, and the news is that the Jewish schools in Britain had very good exam results this year. That's the news. Yes, those are the most important things there. The Jewish Chronicle. This is a picture of one of the historic synagogues in East London, one of the prettiest ones. I don't have a date for this. Now, if we go back into history, you can see by this plaque here, which is a historic, a memorial plaque, because the building doesn't exist anymore, and it says the site of the first synagogue after the resettlement. And the site of the first synagogue, I will explain in a moment, after the resettlement in 1657. And you can see it was Spanish and Portuguese Jewish group who made this plaque. And that's because the first Jews after the resettlement, which I'll explain in a moment, came to Britain from Spain and Portugal. And the reason for 1657 is that before 1657, for a couple of hundred years, Jewish immigration was banned The king said, we don't want any Jewish immigration at all. This was partly for religious reasons, because of course people were very protective about their religion. It was a kind of religious anti-Semitism, which was no fun, but not the same as modern fascist anti-Semitism, just not the same, something completely different. So for a couple of hundred years, Jews were not allowed to come to Britain, and after 1657 it was possible again, and it became possible again for a rather unusual reason, and that was just before the 1657 there was a civil war in Britain, and the Protestants won, very much, the Protestants won. The Catholics were defeated. What does this have to do with Jews? Well, it was a lucky accident, because in fact there were many different kinds of Protestants. And so because they wanted a stable situation, they had to say, okay, you can have your own religious beliefs. It doesn't matter too much. We're not going to have an official state religion, which is very strict. We're going to have a state religion, which is very flexible. As long as you're not a Catholic, it's okay. That was the fundamental thing. And so they passed a new law to say that if you're a Baptist, if you're a Puritan, if you're a Church of England, it's okay. And Jews, oh yeah, okay, if you're a Jew. So the Jews accidentally benefited from a law which was actually passed to help somebody else. And so this is called the resettlement. That is when the Jews were allowed back into Britain. This is in the time of Oliver Cromwell, when... Just 140 years, I think, before the French, the English discovered that you can detach the head of the king from the rest of his body, and this tends to make people happier, except the king. Okay. During the 19th century, then Jewish people could be completely integrated into public life, and so, for example, Benjamin Disraeli, who was a Jew, became Prime Minister of England. So normally, if you can become Prime Minister, it shows that there's a certain amount of integration going on. And he became Prime Minister in 1868. He was an amusing gentleman, was Disraeli, because as well as being Prime Minister, he was a novelist. You don't get a lot of novelists who are Prime Ministers. However, there were still some laws which limited the participation of Jews in public life. In particular, if you wanted to be a member of parliament, you had to swear on the Bible, on my true faith as a Christian. Yeah, I promise to serve the country well. On my true faith as a Christian. That was obligatory until during the 18th and 19th century. So, What could Jewish people do? There were two options. Some of them said, oh, it's only a few words, it doesn't matter. So everybody knew that they were Jewish, but they did the, on my true faith as a Christian thing. But other Jews refused to do this. Sometime towards the end of the 19th century, this condition is eliminated, and you can become a member of parliament without swearing on my true faith as a Christian. I mentioned that after 1880, there were a big wave of Jewish immigration from Russia and from Poland. These were very poor people who had left everything in Russia or Poland because it was too dangerous. And they arrived in Britain, and this is a shelter which was established in 1885. You can see that it is written Jews Temporary Shelter. So it's literally to help the refugees when they arrive. Notice at this time there are no immigration controls. You arrive and you walk in. There's no, you don't need a passport or anything. That's a later invention. Yeah. Now, of course, not many people do come because it's so expensive to travel. But it's a different sort of situation. When the new wave of Jewish immigrants arrived, sometimes the older Jews who had been in Britain for a long time, sometimes well-established families, they were not necessarily very happy. They said, oh, we have a respectable Jewish community, and we have all these very poor people, half of them criminals, yeah, And so there was some conflict inside the Jewish community about whether it was a good thing or not that all these very poor new Jewish immigrants were coming in. And that's the Jewish temporary shelter established in 1885. And there was some political agitation, some political campaigns to defend the Jews in Russia. And you can see here a political meeting, a mass meeting in 1890, which to protest against the inhuman treatment and persecution of Jews in Russia. So this was like a protest meeting, yeah, to protest that Jews in Russia were being persecuted. Something interesting that you can see here is that you can see it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 20 or 25 speakers. Yeah? Would you like to go to a political meeting? There's only 25 speakers. You know, very, very long meetings, tremendously, tremendously long meetings. And maybe you will notice somebody here. Yeah? Eleanor Marx, yeah, the daughter of Karl Marx. William Morris, who's an important artist, and then some people who have come over from Russia. Come early and secure seats. Yeah? If you come late. Now, of course, people did go to political meetings. Remember, they couldn't stay at home and watch YouTube. There was no YouTube. So they did come along. So that's an 1890 meeting. But not everybody was so happy, because here you have a demonstration against the Jews who are arriving. This is one of the first racist campaigns in Britain. 1902, a great public demonstration under the auspices of the British Brothers League, La Ligue des Frères Britanniques. Yeah, même aujourd'hui, ça fait un peu louche, la Ligue des Frères Britanniques. And in fact, this is a sort of keep Britain Christian campaign. Goes back a long way, led by a member of Parliament, Major Evans Gordon. In favour of restricting the further immigration of destitute foreigners. Yeah, we don't want any more of these very poor foreigners. Now, on the poster, it doesn't say Jews, but everybody knows what they're talking about. Yeah, it's an invisible form of discrimination. So, campaign against immigration in 1902, that's a long time ago, but they already had them there. And you can see here, then, a little cartoon, and this is Britannia saying stopping the Russian Jews from coming in. This is a humorous cartoon. Yeah, 19th century humor is bizarre. Mocking Britannia. You know, Britannia says that she is in favor of freedom, but she will not allow these Jews to arrive. So, nevertheless, a large number of poorer Jews did arrive, Jewish refugees did arrive, and they tended to live in the East End of London. The East End of London became the Jewish part of town. And if you walked around the streets in 1910, you would hear Yiddish, a lot of Yiddish. You know. And here you have a marriage in London. You can see it says at the top, United Synagogue London, and written in Hebrew. The East End of London, the Jewish part of London, was a very vibrant culture and produced a series of artists who became quite well known. And here's one of them. It's a theatre play. The title is The Melting Pot, The Great American Dream, by the name of the Jew who lived in London who wrote it is Israel Zangwill. And what is interesting about this play is this is the first use of the word melting pot to talk about mixing cultures. Yeah, and you can see what's happening to them. This is the American dream. They're all coming from all over the world. They're coming to New York, past the Statue of Liberty, and then they are all being melted down to make Americans. Which sounds a little painful, you know, a little hot, But that's the idea. You know, we need to melt ourselves into the new image. That's the original idea of the melting pot, le creuset, militairement le creuset. So you get melted down, but afterwards you're American, so it's okay. Okay, I suppose Israel Zangville. I haven't actually read the play. The largest number of Jewish immigrants in the east of London worked in clothes. We don't think much of clothes today because most of our clothes are, if you look, they're probably made in China. I saw a program on the television the other day. There is one town in China which makes 60% of the socks in the entire world. You know, they make 8 billion pairs of socks every year in one town. This is globalization. This was not the case in the east end of London. And they made clothes. Of course, you had to make clothes, not in big factories, but by hand. And they were specialized. Yeah, there was the trouser makers and the shirt makers. And this is one of the trade unions. And so you can see that this is quite a traditional trade union banner from the time, from 100 years ago. We're marching towards the morning. We're struggling, comrades all. Our aims are set of victory. Our enemies must fall. 1882. But also you can see at the top, it's written in Hebrew. Yeah, so it's got a bilingual culture here. Other artists to come from the Jewish East End. Isaac Rosenberg, a poet. A poet who is still, whose poems are still being read today. Isaac Rosenberg, Poetry Out of My Head and Heart. And one of the painters, Mark Gertler. Mark Gertler. This is a blue plaque. This is something that you've been seeing in France as well over the last 20 years. You have more and more little plaques to say what the history of the place was. It's become more popular, this. And so there's Mark Gertler, who was born in 1891 and lived. And this is one of his paintings. This is the sort of thing he went into with the colours. And I think I have one more. Okay. Following generations of Jewish people in Britain contributed in different ways to the culture. And I'm just going to give you a few of the most famous ones. Harold Pinter, one of the famous British playwrights from the 1950s, 1960s, was of Jewish heritage, and that's the only picture I could find of one of his plays. Okay, there's a Pinter play, Harold Pinter, his famous plays, the Caretaker, and the Birthday Party. The painter Lucian Freud, who is the great grandson, I think, or the great grand nephew of Sigmund Freud. You know, psychoanalyst. You'll notice that in French we often like to make the pronunciation French. So the founder of psychoanalysis in French is Freud. Whereas in England we prefer to approximately imitate the original, and so we say Freud. Yeah, we use the German. This can be important because if you talk to an English person about Freud, they will have no idea who you're talking about. So we say Freud, like in the German. And here are some of his paintings. He's fairly well known. He was he had a major exhibition in Paris a few years ago. And this one on the left is rather interesting because, of course, this is the Queen. Now, it's rather unusual for a portrait of the Queen. What's unusual about it? What do you expect to see if you see a portrait of the Queen? Well, normally you would expect to see something very, very neutral, very, very flattering. Yeah, and I don't think this is really flattering, is it? Not really flattering, is it? Yeah. So it's a real portrait. What I mean to say is it's a real artistic interpretation of somebody. It's not just a... a flattery. It's not just flattery. But what is interesting about it, do you think the Queen liked it? No, not really. Well, it's difficult to say, but it's not as easy as you think, because she asked him to paint the picture. That is, that she sat for him. Now, she didn't tell him how to paint the picture, but nevertheless, she's not stupid. She knew this was Lucian Freud. This is what he paints like. And so, I don't know if she liked it. Huh? And certainly, the conservative newspapers were very angry. Ah, he has insulted our queen. But she did ask that particular artist to come and do her painting. So, you know, maybe she does like it. Because, although, obviously, she doesn't look young and beautiful. But then again, she's not stupid. She knows she's not young and beautiful. Yeah. Whereas, you know, perhaps she looks determined. Yeah, she may have liked it. I don't know. She refused to tell me. She looks grumpy. Wouldn't you be grumpy if you were queen? I mean, all the servants and the money? No. Okay. There you go. She's been in the news again this week. Oskar Kokoschka was a German Jew who moved to Britain and continued to produce. What I like about Oskar Kokoschka is he continued painting until he was 97. And I always like people who continue to do things until they're very, very old. There's another one, Kokoschka. There's been quite an important Jewish contribution to entertainment. And here you had Joe Loss. Joe Loss was a big band leader. This is in the period before discotheques, because there was not enough amplification. If you wanted to get 100 people to dance, you needed a real band. There was no technology to amplify records. And this was the period of the big bands from the 1930s, 1940s, early 1950s. And Joe Loss was one of the people my parents or your great grandparents might have liked. Joe Loss, the big band greats. In the novels, Arthur Koestler was a British, settled in Britain, a Jewish man who settled in Britain and wrote a series of novels which were very influential. Peter Sellers, the actor who played the part of Inspector Clouseau, who is a French detective in British films. And the main object of it is to make French people look ridiculous, really. But there you go. That's something which amuses the English a lot. Okay. I'm sure you wouldn't do anything like that. Amy Winehouse is a more recent British Jew who made her mark in entertainment. And we have some examples of intervention by British Jews in other areas. One of the most important leaders of the radical left, the sort of Olivier Besancenot of Britain in the 1970s, but older, was Tony Cliff, who was born in Palestine in 1917 and died in 2000. I saw him speak, a very, very amusing speaker. Okay, that was a very rapid history of Jewish immigration just in a few minutes' time. I'm now going to do the same with some other groups. So a short history of Irish immigration. Now, I'm part of the history of Irish immigration because my ancestors were Irish and they left the north of Ireland in the 1880s. I don't know what they did as a job, but when you see the marriage certificates, they signed with an X. Yeah, they couldn't sign their name. They just signed with an X. So I guess they weren't millionaires. What could you do? Okay, so a short history of Irish immigration. One of the first things to notice about Irish immigration is that it has very often a remarkable ability to maintain an Irish identity once they have left Ireland. Of course, in the United States, it's not unusual for somebody to say, "I'm Irish." And you say, "Have you ever been to Ireland?" "No." "Did your parents live in Ireland?" "No." "My great-grandparents lived in Ireland, so I'm Irish." Yeah. Of course, one of the wonderful things about identity is you can choose to some extent. And here you have a couple of examples, because there you have a big festival on the left, Liverpool Irish Festival. Now, notice that this does not mean Irish Festival in Liverpool. It is in Liverpool, but it means Festival of Liverpool Irish. And people say, oh, I'm Liverpool Irish, which is an interesting identity, because of course Liverpool is not in Ireland, yeah? Oh, you get, I'm Liverpool Irish. And this is something very specifically Irish that I don't know. I don't know. Do you get, oh, you know, I'm Juan Tunisian. I'm not sure you do. It's something very specific. And so there you have the Liverpool Irish Festival. And here, this is, of course, a beer, because beer is very important, as you know. And this is a Manchester Irish thing. So these are ways in which people identify themselves, because people like to identify themselves in other ways, and not just I am a worker, I am a consumer. And so let's have a look at what happened to the Irish. What were some of the people who were involved? Now, I mentioned that the big immigration was in the 19th century. At the beginning, it was very often seasonal immigration, that is to say that Irish people came to England to work on the farms in the summer and then went back to Ireland for the winter. After the 1850s, large numbers of Irishmen came to Britain. It's generally considered that without the Irish workers, there would be not many railways in Britain. And there are many songs about the Irish working on the railway. Yes? It's dying. Oh, my God. Why did it die? Has it died? My goodness me. How did it do that? It's dying there. Why is it dying? There's no electricity here, is there? Yes. Okay. Thank you. High technology here. It will come back in a moment. A large number of Irish people moving to Britain after the famine. Most of them Catholics, because most Irish people were Catholics, and in particular, most Irish poor people were Catholics. And so you see quite significant numbers of Catholics in Manchester, Liverpool, and around there. Notice also that there was a compromise made in Britain about religious education, and that is to say that in Britain, even today, you have Protestant state schools and Catholic state schools. There are separate schools for Catholic people, but they are not private schools. You don't have to pay. So this is a very specific kind of compromise that was made up in Britain. Just let me get the pictures back there. Irish people have had a long connection with the Labour Party, in particular. James Callaghan is the 1970s Prime Minister who was born in Ireland. And Dennis Healy, Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1970s, also born in Ireland. Going back quite a long way, Irish links here, one of the most outstanding scientists of the 17th century, Robert Boyle. I'm sure you remember the formula. No, there you go. The mathematical equation for Boyle's law, PV equals K. No, I don't understand either. On the side of the arts, one of the better known of the artists connected with Ireland, born in Ireland, is Oscar Wilde. And there you can see... there you can see a statue of Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde died in the 1920s, I think, maybe the 1930s. Rather unusual statue. It's a recent statue, just made a few years ago, because for many, many years, nobody wanted a statue of Oscar Wilde because he was homosexual. And so he was one of the very popular writers, but there were no statues until recently. That this one of his best known plays. Vous voulez aller prendre un café ou quelque chose? Okay, super. The Importance of Being Earnest is his best known play. George Bernard Shaw, again one of the best known playwrights from about 100 years ago. He has a link with Rouen because he wrote a play, Saint Joan. He wrote a play about Joan of Arc. But at this time, remember, this is before the television, before the radio. Theatre was very political, and George Bernard Shaw was very famous because he didn't avoid difficult political questions. So he wrote a play about prostitution, and he wrote another play about the suffragettes and all the difficult issues of the time. He wrote plays about. Not all of them are easy for us to read today, but they do have a certain importance. And of course, the Brontes were Irish of origin. And there are Charlotte Bronte, Emily Bronte, and who's the other one? There are three. There are three sisters. And they had a lot of complications with their name. First of all, because naturally enough, they had to use a man's name. When they wrote their novels, they used a man's name, because it was a time when it was easier to get published if you used a man's name. But there's something else. If you look at Bronte, does that sound Irish? No. And that's because it was not their name. The original name of the family was Punty, P-U-N-T-Y, which is very Irish. And when they came to England, the father changed them. Bronte, that sounds so much more high class than Punty, which was the Irish original name. C.S. Lewis, Irish-born author, who became much more famous in France recently because he wrote the Narnia books. He also wrote a series of books about morals called the Screwtape Letters, which are a series of imaginary letters from a devil to the chief devil. And they're very amusing Irish Catholic stuff. The Pogues don't need to be. They were a punk rock group who introduced Irish traditional music into punk rock and mixed them together. And here you have a picture of St. Patrick's Day Festival in London. Yes, that St. Patrick is the patron saint of Ireland. He came over to Ireland many centuries ago in order to convert the Irish kings or chiefs. And even today, St. Patrick's Day is a big thing in London. It's also a big festival in New York. Again, showing how much identity can be maintained, even though you live a long way from Ireland. And among people who of Irish heritage, when you drink, you raise your glass to somebody, you traditionally say, "A child a year to you, and may you die in Ireland." Yeah? Que vous ayez un enfant chaque année, et que vous ayez la chance de mourir en Irlande. Which is a whole that's a lot of children. Yeah, but then you may die rather young, but let's hope you die in Ireland. Now, the Irish, although Irish people are white, they were still nevertheless subjected to racism, mostly because of their religion. There was an anti-Catholic, even today, you occasionally get anti-Catholic racism in England, and in Northern Ireland it's quite common. In fact, in Belfast, you can see KAT on the walls, kill all Tags, yeah, kill all Catholics. It's not unusual to see it on the road. Now, of course, it's only graffiti. It's not really killing people, but you know, it's not nice to walk in on the side. Yeah, okay, you're coming. Even today, it's more difficult to get a job if you're Catholic in Northern Ireland than Protestant. Yeah. Of course, today the employers are not allowed to ask you, "Are you a Protestant or a Catholic?" They're not allowed to do this. But say, "What school did you go to?" "The school of the Blessed Virgin Mary." Okay, you know, it's very easy to tell. But this is a cartoon. I'm not going to show you a lot of racist cartoons because they're depressing. But here's one from the 19th century, showing the Irish to be as monkeys. Very traditional racism, nothing new about it, but that was in the 19th century. And in the 20th century, there you see, if you look at the pictures of the two Irishmen, it's fundamentally a monkey face. Yeah, it's kind of a monkey face, kind of Neanderthal face, yeah. And so there's always been anti-Irish racism in Britain. It used to be worse. But even today, you can buy in London jokes about stupid Irishmen. You know, it's still not unusual. That was even faster. Just 10 minutes on the Irish. I have two groups left. So I'm going to give you a short history of Southeast Asian immigration to Britain, or as we say in Britain, we just say Asian, because in British culture, when you say Asian, that means India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. The rest of Asia, but Asia's a big place, but the rest of it we don't care about. Yeah, that's the big thing. And it has followed the pattern of many immigrations. That is to say, the first generation were present but were fairly quiet. Yeah? And their children make a bit more noise and want to be present and don't want to just disappear. It goes back a long way because India used to be a colony of Britain. It was an incredible colony. It was the biggest colony in the history of the world. You had England or Britain, which was at the time 30 million people. And in India, there were 300 million people. So it was the biggest colony, a ridiculously big colony. But it was a rather unusual colony because for a very long time, it was run by a private company. The East India Company, that was their headquarters. It's a private company like McDonald's. And it's the Queen of England or the King of England said to this company, I give you the right to govern India. And so it was a private company, but it was a private company with which printed its own money. It was a private company with its own army. Yeah, so it was a rather unusual private company. But this also meant that the British government said, oh, well, cruelty in India, well, we don't know. We're not the company. I love them to stay outside it. So that's the East India House, and that is the money produced by the East India Company. This is in 1808. And you can see that on one side it's written in English, the East India Company, and on the other side in some language from India. And the private company continued to run India for a long time and made a huge amount of money. The English who went out there, they came back with like diamonds this big. I'm not exaggerating. One of the biggest is in Paris. The most biggest diamond in the world is in Paris now, but it was taken from India by the English. It was an extremely profitable deal. And as you can imagine, the English, let's say, did not only do things which we can be proud of. Okay, I think that's fair to say. A few Indian people came to England to live, not very many at this time. But this is one of the more well-known ones. A member of the Indian elite called Saki Muhammad, and he founded the first ever Indian restaurant in London rather a long time ago, in fact, in 1810. The very first Indian restaurant in England is 1810. Of course, this was a very posh elite restaurant. It opened in 1810. Now, Of course, as in many colonies, there were frequently threats of revolts from Indians against British rule and against company rule by the East Indian Company. And the East Indian Company tried to stabilize the situation by helping this king against this king, etc. You know, the usual way of doing things. But then it all exploded. It all exploded in 1857. 1857 is the key date for the history of India, and it all exploded. Why did it explode? Well, partly because, for a long time, the British in India did not interfere in religion. Yeah, they told the evangelical Protestants, no, we don't want you here. let the Indian people keep the Indian religions and we'll just have the economic domination. But in the 19th century, the Protestants' churches in England became very evangelical, and they wanted to go to tell the world, and more of them were coming to India, and this caused a lot of tension. And finally, one day, there was a revolt in the Indian army. The Indian army had British officers, but Indian soldiers. And there was a big revolt in the Indian army. And it began when there was a rumour. I have to explain this a little bit. At the time, you had a rifle, and you had to take the bullets, bite the top of them, and then put them in. That was what you had to do. And there was a rumour that the British had put pig fat in the bullets, which of course is against the Muslim religion, and also cow fat, which is against the Hindu religion. Now, this rumour was not actually true, but people believed it because they were so angry at the British doing more and more things, and this was the last thing. It was an enormous revolt. The Indians occupied several big towns. It looked like British India was finished. But of course, as you can imagine, the British army had better guns, etc. And so there was a massive repression. Thousands of Indian soldiers were killed without a trial. Let's say that the colonial power reacted in the way that colonial powers reacted in these situations. So it split down. Now, I was walking around an art gallery in Leeds, and I saw this picture. And this picture is about the 1857 revolt from the point of view of the imperialists. You can see that the lady, Britain, the tiger, the Indian revolts, and look at all these, the poor white woman who has been killed by the tiger. Yeah. This is a propaganda painting about the Indian rebellion, and it's celebrating the repression of Britain against the terrible, dangerous revolts. There's another picture of the revolt of 1857. Now, the revolt of 1857, when I was at school, they said the Indian mutiny, la mutinerie indienne. And in India, they say the first war of independence. It's a matter of point of view. It's a matter of the different point of view. That's a list. That was in a church in England. I took the photograph. These are British soldiers who were killed in 1857 at the Indian Mutiny of 1857 and 1858. Now, after the revolt of 1857, the imperial power did two things. First of all, they abolished the East India Company. And they became a normal colony with the government deciding. And secondly, they encouraged the development of a small Indian middle class. They opened some universities for the Indians. And they thought, if we allow an Indian middle class to develop, this will stabilise the situation. As colonialists across the world have discovered, one of the problems of creating a middle class is that they very often think, We don't need the colonialists. From the 1890s onwards, there is a rising campaign for the independence of India, of whom the most famous leader is Gandhi. And I don't know if you can see here, but he is stood there in front of number 10 Downing Street, I think. I'm pretty sure that's the number 10 Downing Street in London. He is dressed in this way for a reason. That at this time he was campaigning to... Oh, thank you. Oh, dear. Sorry about that. He was campaigning to boycott British cloth. He said to all the Indians, 300 million Indians, said, what we need to do is make your own clothes in the villages. Don't buy cloth from the British because the British are our oppressors. And so it was a very powerful company. And in general, I can't give you the whole history of Gandhi, but certainly he was... very impressive political leader. One of my favourite campaigns is in 1930. At the time, one of the ways that Britain got money from India was by the salt tax. Every time you bought salt, there was a tax on it. Now, today that doesn't sound very important, But when you have no fridge, salt is extremely important. It's the only way you can preserve meat. So salt was extremely important. And so what Gandhi did is he said, well, we're going to make salt from the sea. This was illegal. And so he had a long march from town to town, said, come with me, we're going to make salt from the sea. And then he arrived at the sea and made some salt, and the British army attacked. And of course, he could not defeat the British army militarily, but this was on the front page of every newspaper in the world, and it was a political victory for Gandhi, because the British Empire was sending the army to stop people making salt from the sea. And they looked extremely stupid. So he defeated the biggest empire in the history of the world. India won its independence in 1947, 1948. I'm not very good with dates, which is embarrassing for a historian, but what can you do? At the end of the 1940s, India won its independence, although it was divided between India and Pakistan. Pakistan, a Muslim state, and India, a Hindu state, and this caused a large amount of killing at the time, the division. It was a very, very unusual moment, because one day the British representatives went to a party in India to celebrate independence with the Indians. And then the next day they went to a party in Pakistan to celebrate independence, and nobody in India or in Pakistan knew where the border was. The British had drawn the border and were keeping it secret because they knew that there would be a lot of fighting. And a month later, they published the border. So in Pakistan celebrated its independence without knowing where its border was. This was a very bizarre colonial situation. To get back to England then, the biggest immigrations from India and Pakistan were in the 1950s, 1960s. Large number of people working in the bus companies in London. Large number of people working in the hospitals. In general, it was easier to get a job in the public sector, because although there was racism everywhere, there was more racism in the private sector. That is, in the public sector, you had an objective recruitment system. Whereas, of course, in the private sector, it's just the boss. Oh, I like you, I don't like you. The next year, in the 1970s, political presence of young Asian people became more visible. And here you have not a very good picture. Here you have a picture of the Asian youth movement, which was founded in the 1970s. And so this is the next generation who wants their conditions to be taken into account. And they would often say, our parents were very quiet and didn't ask for things. But they wanted more. There is one thing we will be looking at next week, which is rather surprising, and that is due to a historical accident. When the Indians and the Pakistanis arrived in Britain in 1948 or 1952, they had the right to vote immediately. All the immigrants had the right to vote. Now, this is not because the British are so generous. It was a kind of accident that for a long time before, there was a law, oh yes, Commonwealth, colonial people can have the right to vote, when there were very, very small numbers of immigrants, and they wrote the law. And so later, when there were a lot of immigrants, they didn't change the law. So it's basically an accident of history, but very useful. Because in London, for example, where there are a lot of Indian and Pakistani people, the politicians, they do listen to some extent, because they have the right to vote. And if you can't vote, it's very difficult to make politicians listen to you, because that's just life. Today, then, there is quite a very significant presence of Asian, Indian and Pakistani culture in Britain. Here you have a mela, and a mela is a festival of Asian music, food, and clothes. And you can see it's quite a big one. It's in the O2, which is an enormous. You can put 10,000 people in there. And you can see that it is funfair, stalls, food, light, music. Yeah, over the last 25 years, the Mela, the festival of Indian and Pakistani culture, is happening in all the big towns. Yeah, it's normal to have a Mela. And with a little public money and a lot of private money, and that's part of today. And certainly the music, Bhangra music, has become, which is a kind of a bit of rock and roll and a bit of Indian traditional music together. And it's become very popular across Britain. A couple of famous people, British people of Indian origin. Freddie Mercury, the lead singer of Queen. One of the reasons I put these in is because we forget where people come from. And in fact, Freddie Mercury was born in Africa. But one of the things which the British colonialists did in Africa, and I apologise, is that the British colonialists really did not want any educated Africans. They didn't want educated Africans. And so what they did was they went to India and they brought 10,000, 20,000 Indians to Africa to work in the intellectual jobs so that there would be no African middle class. See, it's tordu, hein? But this was the... Freddie Mercury was one of this group, that this community... The more you look at the history of the British Empire, the more it's mind blowing, shocking. So Freddie Mercury, of course, a great rocker. Here, just a couple of buildings in London, the different religious buildings from the culture. That's this one is a Hindu temple, and this one is the East London Mosque. It's quite a symbol, it's the East London Mosque. This is recent, about 30 years ago. And you can see that they found some money. They found some money to make a proper mosque. On the musical side, Janoon are one of the big groups. And you get an exchange now that you get groups of British... young people of Pakistani origin who make music in London, which sells very well in Pakistan. And so you get the coming and going there. I recommend Janoon. I think that's pretty sharp stuff. Asian Dub Foundation is the left wing Asian music, very rapid and loud and fun. There's another Mela. It's not a very good picture. And there you have some of the highest paid. These are singers who make a million. Yeah, they're the absolute top. Raghav, Juggy D, people like that. And you often see this expression Desai, which fundamentally is used to mean the same as Asian, Indian, Pakistani. Desai pop concert there. The three of Desai Pop's brightest star. If you go onto the BBC Radio website, you will see, very interestingly, in the series, you have, these are British radio stations which play music. There is Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3. Radio 1, this year's music. Radio 2, music since the 1960s. Radio 3, classical music and jazz. And then you have Asian Network. Yeah. Asian minority ethnic music. And Radio 1 Extra, which is black British music. So you actually have particular national BBC radio stations dedicated to the two musics, which is something specific. In cinema, a couple of Indians have made some progress. Gurinder Chadha, in fact, that's her. A woman director. As you know, there are not many women film directors. And it must have been very difficult for her as an Indian origin woman film director. And she made this film, which is pretty well known, I think. And she occasionally makes other one. That's another one, The Bride and Prejudice. I think it was translated into French as Coup de Foudre à Bollywood. Ce qui est un peu... C'est un titre qui ne correspond pas à ce qu'il y a dans le film. Mais there you go. It's pretty cool stuff. and the novelist Hanif Qureshi, who won a literary prize recently. This is one of his most well-known novels, The Buddha of Suburbia, about children of Indian immigrants and questions of identity, because one of the things which immigrant writers are often expected to write about is questions of identity. In fact, sometimes they're fed up of writing about questions of identity and they'd like to write about football or something else, but they're often... And this was a very successful novel, which I'm afraid I haven't read. British actors of Indian origin include Ben Kingsley, who indeed played Gandhi in the film. There is Ben Kingsley playing Gandhi. The film Gandhi was directed by Attenborough in 1980, and it seems to be... Has anybody seen this film? Yeah, no. It seems to have been forgotten. It's not difficult to find, and it's a very good film. But it's not remained famous. It's true. You don't see it on the television. Which leaves me with just one group left, and everybody seems to be still approximately awake. So that's good. Approximately, yes. Yeah, me too. The history of Caribbean immigration to Britain, although, in fact, British people will always say West Indian and not Caribbean. That's I just put the word Caribbean in there to help you. Now, the British West Indies, Jamaica, Trinidad, these were the colonies in the Caribbean, which were based on sugar, based on the sugar industry and slaves, of course, slaves from Africa. And so the beginning of the story of West Indians in Britain is the story of the abolition of slavery, which was finally brought about in 1833. In 1833, slavery was abolished in the British Empire. There were three reasons. There were probably four reasons that slavery was abolished. First of all, the slaves organized a series of rebellions, sometimes very big ones, in Jamaica and so on. So the slave rebellions were an important element. Secondly, there was a mass movement in Britain against slavery, and this is their symbol. In fact, it was the first mass political movement, the anti-slavery movement in Britain. And they used this symbol... Am I not a man and a brother? Ne suis-je pas un homme? Et donc votre frère? And you can see that this is a slave with chains begging for help. Okay, it's not Malcolm X. It looks very extremely timid by today's... But it was the first mass campaign, so it did have a certain element. Some of the leaders of the campaign... Oh, sorry, I was giving you the reasons. The slave rebellions, the mass movement in Britain, and the third one is a political accident, and that is that the British people who owned the sugar industry in the West Indies were hated by other sections of the British elite for other reasons which had nothing to do with slavery. And so there was a time when... groups of the British elite joined the anti-slavery movement because they hated this group, not because of slavery. That's how history works, you get accidents then. Some of the leaders of the movement in Britain were black, and Equiano is the most famous one. Equiano was an ex-slave who was freed, and he went around Britain giving talks about slavery. And people came to see him, thousands of people came to see him, probably because... When they went to Manchester, most people, they'd never seen a black man. They'd never seen a black man, so they went to say, what are you talking about? And he would speak about slavery. Here's a plaque in the city of Westminster. Lived and published here in 1789, his autobiography on suffering the barbarity of slavery. So Olodo Equiano, one of the heroes. Jumping forward a long time, 100 years later, some of the first organisations of black people in Britain. The League of Coloured People was a 1930s organisation. And what did they do? They organised holidays for children from the black parts of town. So it's kind of a community organisation. But they also organised propaganda. So, for example, they would write pamphlets about black people trying to get a job and what happened to them, you know, the political pamphlets. It has to be said, at this time, the political parties were not really interested. Yeah? The political parties were not really interested in fighting racism. The trade unions were not really interested. They became interested, and today, most anti-racism is funded by trade unions. But in the 1930s, they really weren't interested. One of the terrible things which happened during the Second World War is because of the bombing, the government announced that all children must leave the big cities. And so in Manchester, they literally said, bring your children to the railway station on Saturday and we will take them away and find them somewhere to live in the countryside, because the big cities are being bombed. Yeah, incredible stories that go on. First of all, there was a big social mix because, of course, the children in Manchester, for example, were working-class children. And in the villages, who has a spare room? The middle class. And so you got an enormous social mixing. But one of the terrible things that happened to black children is that they went to the villages, and very often families would refuse to have a black child. And so there was a bit of a campaign around that. It must have been pretty scary. Those stories of evacuation of the children are very amazing, because remember, people didn't have telephones, and people had a lot of children. And after the war, some of the children came home and their parents had moved. They never saw them again. You know, it's a really tragic stories involved, yeah, which are very historical. Here is then one of the first political organisations of black people in Britain. Come and hear all about Jamaica from well-known Jamaicans in London, Wednesday, September the 14th. Meeting called by the League of Coloured People. Yeah, so information from home for. One of the leaders of the League of Coloured People was Una Marson, who was a playwright. She wrote plays. And there she is. And that's her biography. I bought this biography, but I haven't read it yet. You know, one of the things about being a historian is you buy books, but you don't read them. You just buy them. So I've got this book at my book at home, The Life of Una Marson. Well, one of the leaders of the first of the League of Coloured People, then one of the first black organisations. And here, finally, for today, this is a picture of the Windrush. And the Windrush is a ship. And it is the first ship in 1948 to come to Britain from Jamaica to bring the men who wanted to work in Britain. So it's not the biggest ship, it's just a symbol, it's the first one. 48. 1948, yeah. Because suddenly there was no more war. Britain needed a lot of workers, especially in building. And so this is the first. And you can see that they're intending to have a good, they're intending to enjoy themselves. And we shall see next week what happened there. It's only 5:02, but I'm going to stop there so I can get the room emptied and so on. Thank you for listening.